This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Ed Murphy is an astronomer at the University of Virginia and joins us regularly on this little show to keep us updated about all things space and everything going on. Are you going tonight?
No, I'm not. I'm staying home tonight.
Me too.
My son has a Cub Scout meeting in the neighborhood, so we'll be going just down the street to a Cub Scout meeting.
Well, you don't have to get out on 29.
No, that's right.
Well, thank goodness.
Yes.
They're saying like, 50, 60,000 people.
That's what I've heard.
And it's going to be much worse because they're not football fans who know Charlottesville, generally speaking.
Yeah, and know where to park and know the best way to get to their parking space.
Yeah, they know how to get in and out of town. This is a whole lot of folks who don't come to Charlottesville
that's
regularly.
That's right, yeah. So.
Going to be an interesting evening.
It will.
Yeah. Ed, let's start, if we can, with that the committee that was advising the president on human spaceflight.
That's right.
Get us up to speed about what this is, where it comes from, and what's going on. Because this is really important.
It's huge, actually. I think it's one of the biggest events in the human spaceflight program since the 1970s. And what's going on is that the president has asked for a top-to-bottom review of NASA's plans for the human spaceflight program. And it starts back with President Bush back in 2004 when he decided that NASA needed to do something new and bold. And he gave them a vision of going to the moon before 2018. Well, the shuttle couldn't get them there, so they needed to build a whole new rocket to get astronauts into space because the plan even back then was to retire the space shuttle. Then they needed a big heavy lift rocket that could lift the giant components that you need to go to the moon and land on the moon. Then they needed to develop the lunar lander. And all this was part of this package that the president put together in 2004 with the goal of getting us to the moon again in 2018. And what has happened since then is that the budget predictions that they had in 2004 haven't come to pass.
And, yeah, to say the least.
To say the least. And today, NASA is looking at not being able to accomplish those goals. And the Augustine Commission was put together. Norman Augustine, who's a former CEO of Lockheed Martin Aerospace, is leading up this group. And he and his committee are looking at human spaceflight and laying out the options for the president as to what NASA can do.
So Obama comes in and says, my predecessor wanted to do this. We don't have the money for anything remotely like this.
That's right.
So I'm going to put this Blue Ribbon Commission together. Give me some options. What can we do vis-a-vis human spaceflight
exactly.
And exploration?
That's right. And what they're laying out, so they've already published their executive summary, the summary of their paper. They're briefing the president, and today they're supposed to present the final report to the president's office.
That's today. Wow.
So it's today. So I think looking at the president's schedule over the next couple of days with this trip to Copenhagen, he's not likely to look at it today or tomorrow.
Right,
but
right.
But the belief is that he will be briefed on it soon, and then we'll come to a decision as to what to do with the human spaceflight program in the U.S.
So what do we know? We're talking with UVA astronomer Ed Murphy, and the phone lines are always open at 977-1070. Ed, what do we know about some of the ideas the committee is going to be telling the president about?
The committee is basically going to lay out five options to the president, and assuming that the president can choose one of these five options or may try to do something different, I suppose, if he doesn't like the five options. But they're laying out five options, two of which are constrained by the current budget, three of which are not constrained by the current budget. But I will say for anyone who is a large fan of the manned spaceflight program, none of the five options are very appealing. And none of them get us back to the moon before 2020. Many of them, I would argue, don't do anything interesting. So,
oh, gosh. Now, why is that? I mean, why no bold vision out of this committee?
It really comes
was
down
to money.
Was that
not their charge? I mean,
that was part of their charge. They just couldn't see in the current budget fiscal climate that there would be that much money available. So if they want to carry on with the president's current plan, with President Bush's plan, the one what they're calling the program of record, the one that we're working on right now, which is to retire the space shuttle next year in 2010 and retire the space station in 2016. And we can talk about each of those in a minute, why we have to do it. But if we proceed with that, we still won't get back to the moon until the 2020s, and that would still require an extra $3 billion a year above what NASA's getting right now.
Holy cow.
With the budget that NASA's getting right now, the baseline program that they laid out, what they're calling the program of record, with no improved funding, says that the space shuttle retires in 2011, We deorbit the International Space Station in 2016. We build a replacement for the space shuttle, which doesn't get finished until 2017, 2018. And there's only enough money to build that heavy lift launcher in the late 2020s. And there's never any money available to build the lander that will land the astronauts on the surface.
So, Ed, for the foreseeable future, due to this historic downturn in the economy, is human spaceflight over as far as the Americans are concerned?
Well, that's one of the arguments that I think needs to be put on the table. One of the arguments that we can talk about in a minute is whether there should be human spaceflight if that money couldn't be better spent elsewhere in spaceflight programs with robotics, for example.
Yeah.
But in any case, even if there is an extra $3 billion a year put into the human spaceflight program, we're still not going to get to the moon before the mid-2020s or later.
Yeah, and likely much later. We're talking with Ed Murphy, astronomer from the University of Virginia. Before we talk about some of the options and the direction that you would like to see, why do we need to retire the space shuttle? What's going on with that and retiring the space station? They said deorbit the space station.
That's right.
Does that mean bring it down?
Bring it down. That's right. So the two reasons are the space shuttle, first of all, after the Columbia accident in 2003, the Columbia Accident Investigation Board, the committee that they impaneled to investigate what happened and make recommendations to NASA, said that if they were going to fly the space shuttles beyond 2010, they needed to do basically a top-to-bottom safety review of the whole space shuttle system. And in addition, Like commercial airliners, these space shuttles have a limited amount of time before they can fly without inspections. And the inspections come at various levels, some of which literally require tearing the orbiters apart and investigating every seam, every rivet, every wire, and putting them all back together. And those two are both coming to pass. In 2010, if they want to fly the shuttles much beyond that, they would have to undertake this safety review. And they would have to start tearing the shuttles apart to do these inspections that were required when they were built. So,
all of which is incredibly expensive.
Yeah. And all of which makes the program that much more difficult to conceive of continuing on just running with the space shuttle, saying, let's forget about doing anything new and let's just keep the space shuttle going. That's not really an option right now because of these two issues.
And the space station is going to be brought down as well, right?
Well, that's one of the things that the Augustine Commission is talking about. The space station construction will be finished in 2011. And they point out that it's not realistic to think that we would spend 20, 25 years building the space station and then utilize it for only 5 and then bring it back down. But the problem is the current NASA budget is built on no funds for the International Space Station after 2016. So if you want to keep the space station running and do all these other things, it's just not planned in the current budget scenarios.
Why no long-term budget for this thing we spent decades building?
Because I think these budgets were made long ago, and of course, for every administration, that was somebody else's problem down the line. So,
gosh. Now, you have pointed out to us before in previous conversations what a waste, in not your words, but a boondoggle the space station has been.
That's right.
Yeah, remind us of this line of thinking, because it's just unbelievable.
When it's finished next year or in early 2011, the space station will have cost us $100 billion. And when I look at that compared to other science programs, which have all been far cheaper than that, we get far, far more science and far more discoveries and results out of other programs. And ultimately, I think the space station comes down to not being worth the $100 billion that we will have spent on it.
So is it just corporate welfare? I mean, is that what it was? It was just padding the budget for folks like Lockheed Martin?
I think that's a part of it. I think part of it was that a lot of the space station was spread. Construction of components for the space station was spread out to many different congressional districts. So congressmen had a hard time killing it because they would be reducing jobs, losing jobs in their own districts because of killing it. I also think that early on it seemed to everybody to be the right way to go. We needed to learn how to live in space. If our next step would be long-term presence on the moon or Mars, we needed to learn how to let people survive in space for long periods of time.
And that's been done.
So,
and we know it messes you up.
That's right. Right now, we've learned that after about 6 months, 6 months is a reasonable time to let someone spend in space. We've learned from the Russians. The U.S. has never had an astronaut spend more than, we've never had an astronaut spend a year continuously in orbit. The Russians had someone who spent over 400 days in orbit, and we found that that's actually devastating on the human body.
What happens to that person?
Basically, their muscles, even though they're exercising all the time, their muscles still atrophy, but they lose a lot of bone density is the primary concern. And it's because the way that your bones stay strong is because they're always working against the force of gravity. Even if you're not exercising on a regular basis, just standing up stresses your bones and builds them up. And when you're in space and your body says you don't need those bones, it pulls the calcium out, you lose your bone density, and your bones become very, very fragile and brittle.
Wow. Gosh. And do we know what happened to that guy who was up there for over a year?
So for the people who are up for 6 months...
He's just laying in a bed somewhere
now? He's not crippled, but he'll probably never have the strength that he had before he went into orbit. For the people who are staying up only for 6 months, it appears that there's no long duration. There's no long-term damage that's done if you're only up for 6 months.
Yeah.
So it seems to be somewhere between, probably 9 to 15 months in orbit. Somewhere in there, you start reaching the range of serious issues about permanent long-term damage.
Yeah. And there's no way to create a false gravity inside of a spaceship?
There is. You could spin it is one idea. We have no way to make artificial gravity, but one way you could make a substitute for gravity is to spin a spacecraft very quickly. We've probably all been in carnival rides where you're spinning and you feel yourself pushed up against the wall. So you can make a spacecraft spin to try and mimic gravity. The problem with that is to get anything close to Earth gravity, the spacecraft has to be spinning very, very quickly. And when it's spinning very quickly like that, there's a force that comes into play that you and I rarely experience in our everyday lives called the Coriolis effect that makes it very unusual. And that is, if we're sitting still here and I throw a ball straight across to you, it will go straight across. But in a spinning spacecraft, if I throw that ball, it will appear to curve. And if it's spinning fast enough, if you just reach out to push a button, your arm will curve because of the Coriolis effect.
Oh, gosh.
And so there's only a certain speed that you can spin things before.
That we can tolerate.
That humans can tolerate on an everyday basis. And it turns out, in order to mimic the Earth's gravity and spin slow enough that they're not constantly sick, the spacecraft has to be huge. It has to be of order a kilometer in size, half a mile across or so, before the spin gets reasonably slow enough that they could have a relatively normal life.
And that's going to cost a lot more than $100 billion to get like that up
that's
in
right.
space.
That's right. We've never done anything like that before.
And it's not just, we're talking with UVA astronomer Ed Murphy, it's not just the loss of bone density of long-term space travel and being in space for a long time, but isn't it the one of the larger concerns is just the radioactivity?
Yeah, that's right. Radiation damage, and that comes primarily from the sun, solar flares. Here on the surface of the Earth, we're protected by two things. We're protected by the Earth's magnetic field and the Earth's atmosphere above us. And so those of us here on the surface of the Earth have very little to worry about, even by a major solar flare, at least in terms of radiation damage to our bodies. Now, we do have to worry about our satellites and other things, but not our bodies. But once you get into the space station, you're outside the Earth's atmosphere, but you're still inside the Earth's magnetic field. And that magnetic field provides a tremendous amount of protection from solar flares. That said, there are a couple occasions where they've been worried about the astronauts in the International Space Station and had them take refuge in one of the better shielded components just because they were worried about a solar flare. But if you go to the moon or you go to Mars, you're outside the Earth's magnetic field. And at that point, you have no protection except the protection that you're carrying along. And in that case, you're very much exposed to the radiation from the sun. And in that case, even a moderate-sized solar flare, if it's aimed in the direction where you happen to be at the time, would produce a lethal amount of radiation.
It just goes right through the walls of the spaceship, right through your body.
That's right, exactly.
And does it kill you instantly, or you just go? Everybody goes home with cancer?
It depends on the dose. So a moderate dose over long periods of time could cause cancer. A very large dose given very quickly will induce radiation sickness, which will incapacitate you, and then you'll die a few days later.
Oh, gosh. And there's no way to, coat the spaceship walls with some magic dust
or something? You could build a spaceship out of lead, which is very heavy and hard to get into space. One of the more novel ideas is, of course, if you're an astronaut going to Mars, you have to bring a lot of water around with you. So maybe you put your water tanks on the outside of the spacecraft and you're living on the inside of those water tanks. So the water alone provides some protection. So you can imagine schemes where you can protect yourself. It's just that it requires such a mass density of protection that right now we have no way to get that quantity of material into space cheaply.
So we'll talk about your ideas for the solution to this in terms of robotic exploration, which I think, honestly, you know, since the 60s, that's what's really gotten all the attention. That's been the great discoveries have been these robots and these rovers and things like that.
I would argue that all of the major discoveries in astronomy and space science have come out of the robotic missions in the last 30 years. And the human spaceflight program has produced very little in terms of scientific results in that same period of time.
We're talking with UVA astronomer Ed Murphy. Let's pick up with that when we get back after a break for local news and weather. And also, we're going to talk in detail as well in the next half hour about all of this news about water on the moon.
Yes.
That coming up in just a few minutes. You're listening to Charlottesville right now. We're talking with UVA astronomer Ed Murphy. He joins us on occasion on this program, and we always look forward to him stopping by and keeping us updated about all things space. Ed, before we went to a break, we were talking about how to fund space exploration and human flight, and you're thinking, and I agree wholeheartedly, that doesn't it make much more sense to put money into robotic space exploration, like what we've seen on Mars?
That's right. I sincerely believe we have reached the point in history where our machines, when it comes to working in dangerous places like space, are now better capable and more able than humans are. And that for machines, at least, that will only increase, I think, dramatically in the next decade or two, especially if investment is put into it. I mean, we've seen some amazing things with our rovers on Mars operating now since 2004, 5 years operating on the surface of Mars. A great story that people always used to tell about human exploration was when on Apollo 17, Harrison Schmitt, the only scientist who actually went to the moon as part of the Apollo missions, was walking along and churned up with his foot some orange soil. And immediately recognized this as being something special that he needed to investigate. And people said that's the value of putting geologists, putting humans there, is that they can make discoveries like that. And then what happens with the rovers on Mars is they're driving along, the wheels churn up the soil. And a few years ago with the Spirit rover, they turned the camera around and they took a picture and they saw that the rover had stirred up some interesting colored soil. And they went back and made a major discovery of finding salt-like compounds on the surface of Mars, indicating that there was once water there. Our robots are able to do just what the humans can do, but they can do it far cheaper and with far less risk. And I think it's a better place right now to be putting our investment.
Why don't you think we see this type of thinking among the folks who have the purse strings, our representatives in Washington, who decide how this money is going to be spent? They seem so reluctant to say, okay, we're going to really funnel this into robotics because that really does make sense.
I think there's a lot of reasons. I think one has to do with national prestige. They're worried that if we don't invest in human spaceflight and other countries do invest in human spaceflight, that somehow they will be ahead of us. But the example I like to give is imagine that the Chinese do decide to pursue a moon mission and they get to the moon in a decade and a half or 2 decades from now. And when the Chinese astronauts get there at tremendous expense and tremendous risk, what if they find a dozen of our satellites in orbit around the moon and a dozen rovers operating on the surface, and we're doing much better science for far less money? Who's ahead in the race? I argue that we are, even though ours are not human, they are robotic. I believe that when it comes to mining asteroids or any long-term future in space, we will not have human beings mining asteroids. That is a job that machines are fit perfectly to do. And anything you can think of doing in space is I think, better done with machines.
My guest is UVA astronomer Ed Murphy. We're honored to have him live in studio. If you have a question, it's 977-1070. Ed, water on the moon. What is this all about?
So this is one of the big parts of human exploration. Human beings need water, and we need tremendous amounts of water. And in fact, just this past summer, for the very first time, the International Space Station went from a crew of 3 people to a full-time crew of 6 people, primarily because they were able to get the water recycling system up and running on the space station. And this takes things like sweat and condensation and even urine, and it recycles it into fresh water that the astronauts can use. The limiting case in many of these ideas of space exploration is how much water you can bring along for the astronauts. So if you can go someplace where there's a lot of water, you save yourself having to haul water. And anyone who's carried a big bucket of water knows it's heavy and it's very expensive to cart around to launch into space. So back in the, for many years, scientists had wondered whether there was water on the moon. Now, we certainly know there are no lakes and rivers on the moon. That certainly doesn't exist. But back in the 60s, they were wondering whether the moon may not have water in the minerals of the rocks. I know when you think of a rock here in Virginia, you don't think of it as having much water inside. But in fact, many of those minerals are hydrated. There is water tied up in the minerals of the rock. In the late 60s and early 70s, when the astronauts brought the lunar samples back, they were bone dry. There was very, very little, if any, water in the samples. And what little water there was, people chalked up to being contamination, the fact that astronauts had to put them in boxes, which then splashed down in the Pacific and were brought back to Houston. Even with all the careful handling, there may have been some contamination. So there was very, very little water. And that developed this belief that the moon is bone dry, that there's no water in it at all. And that, in part, led to a whole new idea about where the moon came from, that the moon derived from a Mars-sized body smashing into the Earth. And then in the late 80s and 1990s, missions to the moon started discovering at the South Pole and the North Pole of the moon, where there's these really deep craters, that the sunlight never reaches the bottom of these deep craters, that there was something down there that had the signature of ice. And so maybe these deep craters have a little bit of ice in them just because it's so cold there. Now, this ice probably comes from things like comets that strike the moon and vaporize, and this water vapor works across the surface. And when it gets to these really cold craters at the North and South Pole down in the bottoms, it freezes out there. And the idea with this new goal of going back to the moon was to go to the South Pole of the moon and put a permanent base near one of these craters that's filled with water so that the astronauts could pull this water out. And they can use it not only for drinking, but they can use solar light to break the water into hydrogen and oxygen atoms, which oxygen, of course, you need to breathe. And hydrogen and oxygen combined is a terrific rocket fuel. That's what powers the main engines on the space shuttle. So the idea of having water on the moon was really, it was important for the human exploration of the moon, of having this source that they could go tap when they're there. Now, the big news that came out 2 weeks ago was that there was an American instrument, a scientific instrument on an Indian satellite that was studying the moon and had been in orbit around the moon for a few months. And what they discovered was that not only is there likely water ice at the poles, but they found that there are many hydrated minerals across the surface of the moon. So this made huge headlines in the last couple of weeks, but I want to temper it and come back a second and say, where does this water come from? The idea is that hydrogen atoms, the sun is throwing off this wind of hydrogen atoms. The rocks on the moon contain a lot of oxygen, and every now and then one of these hydrogen atoms will smash into an oxygen atom on the moon and form OH, and then another hydrogen atom will hit that and it will form H2O. It'll form a little bit of water. But this is a minuscule amount of water, and it's probably contained right on the surface of the moon. And the problem with this latest discovery that didn't come out very much is that the amounts of water that we're talking about are minuscule. It's interesting to geologists, and it's interesting to scientists from a scientific point of view.
But they didn't find a pool of water.
They didn't find a pool of water, and they didn't find anything that astronauts could exploit in the human exploration of searching the moon or living on the moon.
That doesn't mean that there's not still the possibility of ice at the bottom of
those craters. That's right. So that's still a big question. Is there ice at the bottom of those craters? So that hopefully will be answered next Friday morning at 7:30. So, yeah, I can tell you the date and the time.
That's great.
So next Friday morning at 7:30, the United States is going to smash a second stage of an Atlas V rocket called the Centaur Upper Stage. It's going to smash into the South Pole of the moon in a crater called Cabeus, which is down there at the South Pole, one of these permanently shadowed craters that they think there's ice in it. And this rocket was what launched the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. The United States has an orbit around the moon right now, a robot called the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, that's mapping the surface of the moon, studying its mineralogy and its surface, in part to get ready for sending astronauts back, but in part just for the scientific discovery of it all.
Yeah.
And as part of that, they've decided to take the large upper stage of the rocket, and rather than just discarding it in space, they're going to smash it into one of these craters in the hope that it will liberate any ice that's in there.
Can they actually direct it from here from the Earth? Can you actually direct it that accurately?
Oh, yeah.
This far away?
And in fact, what they have tied to it is this little tiny spacecraft called the Shepherding spacecraft. Normally, those rocket stages, when their job is done, they're not very smart. They don't have a lot of computers or ability to orient themselves. They don't have any power supplies other than batteries. So normally when those stages are done, they very quickly die and they become a piece of space junk. So they attached to it a little satellite called the Shepherding satellite. And the job of this little satellite was to get that thing to the moon and get it targeted on a particular crater. And just a few days ago, they picked the final target, this crater Cabeus, that it's going to crash into. And so on Friday morning, they're going to aim this Centaur stage. And it's got the mass of a sport utility vehicle. It'll be traveling 6,000 miles an hour when it crashes into the bottom of this crater. And it's estimated that it'll make a crater that's about 20 to 30 yards across and probably about 4 to 5 yards deep. And it will liberate thousands and thousands of pounds of rock and dust and hopefully some ice. Now, what will happen less than a day before impact is that little shepherding satellite will finally detach itself from that upper stage. And that upper stage will go ahead and crash into the moon, and the shepherding satellite will hang back a little bit. And 4 minutes later, it's going to come through all this stuff that was thrown up in the impact, and it will sample it before it, too, smashes into the surface of the moon.
How does it sample it? What does it do?
It's got a variety of instruments on board with the goal, sole goal of discovering water in that material.
And so, it has just like a big flat screen that the stuff hits that we can read?
No, it's going to use devices to measure what the minerals are made of. And so what the minerals on the rocks and look for the signature of water there.
Similar to what the rovers have on Mars.
Yeah. And then as that's all happening, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter is flying over, and it will use its cameras to look for the signature of ice. And at the same time, dozens of telescopes on the Earth will be observing that spot on the moon to see this material that was thrown up to see if they can find the signature of ice.
Now, what are you expecting?
I'm expecting that they'll find some water ice. I think they will find less than they expected, but I think they'll find some water ice down
there.
How
deep is the crater that this thing is going to fall into?
Oh, it's a huge crater. I can't remember the exact diameter. It's about 50 or 60 miles across, if I remember right. It's a very big crater.
Wow.
And it's only going to make a little tiny crater inside of it.
Yeah. So. Well, that's very exciting. So that's a week from tomorrow.
A week from tomorrow. So now, unfortunately, it's happening at 7:30 Eastern time on Friday, so there's nothing we can see here. If you were out on the West Coast and you had a telescope, I'd recommend that you get up early, and so it'll be 4:30 in the morning Pacific time, and watch that part of the moon. You may see a little flash as this thing hits the surface of the moon.
Will NASA TV have it online?
They'll probably have it live, yes.
Yeah, almost certainly.
This is a huge mission for
NASA. For folks who don't know, that's a great resource there's anything going on in space.
That's right.
NASA TV.
NASA TV. And they carry it live on the NASA webpage, nasa.gov, or some network, some of these satellite networks carry it. You can find the station, you know, on your satellite TV.
We're talking with UVA astronomer Ed Murphy. We have a couple of minutes left. What's the latest on the MESSENGER mission? And remind us what this is.
So MESSENGER is a robot that we're sending to Mercury right now. And MESSENGER was yesterday had a pass by Mercury. It was its very last pass by Mercury before hopefully it goes into orbit around Mercury in 2011. It was launched back in August of 2004. And what's interesting about MESSENGER is, you know, Mercury is 40% the distance from the sun that we are. So they're about twice as close to the sun as we are. And you'd think that would be easy to get to if we've sent things way out beyond Pluto, that just that little distance. But you have to lose a lot of speed to get that close to the sun. Maybe it sounds counterintuitive, but the Earth is held in orbit by its speed. And if you want to get closer to the sun, you have to lose some of that speed to allow yourself to fall in. And we didn't have a rocket stage big enough to send MESSENGER directly to Mercury. So when it was launched, MESSENGER had to take this looping orbit around the inner solar system where it passed the Earth and used use the gravity of the Earth to slow itself down so that it could fall into where Venus was. And then it had two passes by Venus, each time losing a little bit of its speed to get it down to where Mercury is. Now it has three passes by Mercury to lose enough speed so that in March of 2011, it can actually go into orbit around Mercury.
Ed, is there somebody sitting in a lab somewhere in America, you know, for the past few years, people taking turns flying this thing?
Yeah. So this is operated out of the Applied Physics Lab at Johns Hopkins University up in Laurel, Maryland. So
amazing. And they're just pressing keyboards to controlling this thing.
Yeah, it's actually done much.
They don't have a joystick, do they?
No, they don't have a joystick. No, and everything's very carefully planned. I mean, this whole mission was planned long before launch ever came. So everything is planned out into the long distant future. So they're not making, hopefully, the whole goal of these things is that you're making very little real time decisions. Although they did have that yesterday as the spacecraft flew by Mercury. At closest approach, it flew, by the way, within 142 miles of the surface of Mercury.
Which is a first for us, right?
No, this is the third time it's been by Mercury. But it did see parts of Mercury that we had never seen before. So about 5% of Mercury had never been photographed before, and it did photograph that for us. But right at the moment of closest approach yesterday, the spacecraft computers sensed an error on board, and they safed the spacecraft. And that's when spacecraft operators get really worried, because that means something's wrong.
And real quick, what are we expecting out of MESSENGER when it starts to orbit Mercury?
We're hoping to learn all about the geology of Mercury. Mercury is really interesting because it's one of the few planets, rocky planets like the Earth. It has a magnetic field just like the Earth does. And we're really interested in figuring out why it has a magnetic field. And we're interested in learning all about the chemistry of the rocks down on the surface.
Fascinating. That really is something. Ed Murphy is an astronomer at the University of Virginia. Remind us again of the website for the observatory here, where folks can get information about the open nights.
They can just go to the astronomy department webpage, which is www.astro.virginia.edu, and then you'll see a public outreach link there, and you can follow that.
Good deal. Ed, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.